This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
FUBAR Radio and UN Women UK present a live 24-hour radio show.
24 hours.
Was Alicia Keys' girlfriend. This is FUBAR Radio, and we're going to go straight to the phone lines to Dr. Joanna Williams. Dr. Joanna Williams, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being part of the show. You are the author of Women Versus Feminism. Talk to me about this book.
So I wrote this book really from a background of being a feminist myself and believing passionately in men and women being equal and women being able to take on the world and do whatever men did. That was very much the background I was coming from. And I gradually just became more and more concerned that feminism was actually about sending out the opposite message to women today, that there's a mainstream feminism where the narrative is that women are actually victims That's constantly reminding women how disadvantaged they are in a way that actually doesn't bear any relationship to reality and can become very disempowering and very debilitating to constantly be told that you're paid less than men, that you're worthless, that you're going to be beaten up, that there's a rape culture. Yeah. And like I say, if you actually explore the statistics, these tales of woe don't really match up to reality. And yet this is the message that we're constantly bombarding women with, and I don't think it does women any favours whatsoever. So my book really was a challenge to that, to try and say that actually it's pretty great being a woman today. There's lots of areas where we're actually doing better than men, and we're not victims, and we don't want to have our freedoms restricted as if we were.
You talk about their freedom. You're a campaigner for academic freedom. What, without asking a stupid question, what do you mean by that?
Well, academic freedom to me is very much equated to freedom of speech, which is the way that people would see it more generally. So I think academics in particular need freedom of speech to be able to push the boundaries of knowledge, to be able to test received wisdom, to challenge orthodoxies. And I think often today it's very easy for academics and everybody on a university and in society more broadly to become quite conformist in their outlook. You try saying something outrageous on Twitter and you soon find that there are Twitter mobs braying for you. And obviously the definition of what's outrageous today seems to change all the time, and the barrier for what's outrageous gets lower. So even suggesting that there might be a link between biology and gender, that a woman has a female anatomy, is enough to set mobs onto you today. And I think that the result, like I say, can become quite, can encourage people to self-censor and to not say what they think, which is not helpful for debate. And it can create a very conformist political environment where doing things like challenging feminism, for example, can make me very, very unpopular.
Yeah. And it's, but you know what? It's brave you're doing it, you know. Let's talk about inspirational women. Who would you say are your inspirational, either your inspirational woman or your inspirational women?
Oh, that's a very good question. Yeah. So going back through history, going back to the suffragettes, I would have to say that my favourite of all was Sylvia Pankhurst. Yep. And I think Sylvia, rather than her mother Emmeline or her sister Christabel, we hear an awful lot more about Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother. But for me, it's actually Sylvia who's my real hero, because she, so I'm sure everybody's aware that the centenary that we're celebrating at the moment of votes for women actually only applied to some women. It was only women over the age of 30 and women who owned property. So it was only really a few posh older women who got given the vote 100 years ago. And Sylvia Pankhurst was absolutely adamant that the vote should be given to all women and to all men as well, that she didn't want the vote to be tied to how much money people had or whether they owned property, but that it was individual people who needed the vote. And I think there's really important lessons there for feminism today about working with men, alongside men, not seeing men as the enemy, if you like, and the idea that men and women have got common cause with each other. To fight for rights alongside each other rather than opposed to each other.
And it is true, isn't it? And, you know, having, say, for me, the reason why I wanted to do a show like this was to start that conversation. Like you say, talk about feminism, whatever your views are. Talk about the He for She campaign, men and women working together. How important do you think it is that we are talking about things like this?
I think it's absolutely vital. But I think there's a bit of hypocrisy at the moment among a lot of people who do say that men and women should be working together, because they're not really on about looking at what men and women have got in common. They're really just wanting to convert men to feminism. So, for example, we hear an awful lot about the gender pay gap, and we hear a lot about celebrities and women presenters at the BBC who have enormous salaries. I mean, salaries that I just couldn't could never in a million years imagine. I mean, I wish, but I could never imagine earning that much money. And they talk about the gender pay gap. Whereas if you have a look at men and women who are in much lower paid jobs, men and women who are on minimum wage jobs, there's actually zero gender pay gap, because if you earn the minimum wage, then you get the minimum wage whether you're a man or a woman, and gender just doesn't come into it. And so I think for men and women who are in jobs rather than very, very well-paid careers, they're much better off fighting for their interests, fighting for more money alongside each other. Whereas what feminism does is sometimes it does talk about wanting to recruit men, but it's wanting to recruit men into a project which is about, I think, protecting the interests or furthering the interests of a small and elite group of very privileged women, rather than defending the interests of men and women as equals.
Well, look, Dr. Joanna Williams, thank you so, so much for joining us today here at Food Bar Radio. I really appreciate you taking the time out.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. You take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Dr. Joanna Williams. We are going to go now to a song, Free Money by Patti Smith. Don't go anywhere.
Every night before I go to sleep, find a ticket, win a lottery, scoop the pearls up from the sea, cash them in and buy you all the things you need. Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills go swirling at my bed. I know they're stolen, but I don't be bad. I take that money, buy you things you never had. Oh, baby, it would mean so much to me. Oh, baby, to buy all the things you need. Oh, babe, I'll buy you a jet plane, babe. Get you on a higher plane to a jet stream and take you through the stratosphere and check out the planet and then take you down deep. Where it's hot, hot in Arabia, baby, then cool, cold, you feel the snow, and we'll roll, drain, roll, drain, roll, roll, drain, drain. When we're dreaming, when we're dreaming, when we're dreaming, we're dreaming, dreaming for free, free money, free money, free money.
Patti Smith, Free Money. This is FooBar Radio. We are very much into the 24-hour live show, supporting the He for She campaign, raising money and awareness, working alongside UN Women UK. Remember, if you want to donate, all money donated is going towards changing the reality for women and girls globally. All you need to do is text UN Women 15, followed by the amount you want to donate to 770. I am joined in the studio by Aminka.
Hello!
Do you know what? The ray of energy right now is perfect.
But you know what? I'm actually quite shaken up. I almost saw two cats outside get run over, and that's really just scarred me. Yeah, and cats. I think that I can't unsee that. That really just happened.
I can't unsee it.
Oh, my word.
It's like, what's happening here? Aminka, thank you so much for being my co-host in this part of the show. You
are for sure, honey. You know what? It's nice because I literally just came from a He for She night last night.
Oh, wow.
Which was, very funky. Indeed, the vaults in Waterloo are popping off.
The Waterloo vaults, amazing.
It's like a whole new world of bean bags and fake ivy and incense burning. It's literally like a festival just brought to an underground graffiti town. It's amazing. So so I was there. He for She was there, and it was quite a sick night. And I'm feeling a type of way, but so are you, because you've been up for 19 hours.
I feel like I've been up for eternity, but it's good. Nothing caffeine can't look after us.
And Harry Bows.
A lot of Harry Bows. On the phone lines right now, we have another guest on the phone lines. We've got Anuvab Pal, one of India's top stand-up comedians. Hello, Anuvab.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
I am well, actually. Well, thank you for having me. And from what I hear, this has been going on for a couple of days. You guys have been on air for a while.
Yes. I went on air. I'm trying to think what day it is today. Yesterday at... I've just been told it's Saturday, right? yesterday at 5 p.m.
I can't really say anything. I've only just joined half an hour ago. But I'm still trying to jump...
You are still here.
Anuvab,
you have been listed by the Times of India as one of India's top five comedians. Your play, The President Is Coming, was made into a Bollywood film as well. I mean, you are just doing incredible. Let's start at the beginning, get to know you a little bit better. Have you always wanted to be a comedian?
You know, that's a really good question. The interesting thing is that, you know, I live in a country with a billion people. And there's a constant conflict between sort of very Western modernism, you know, with its values, and sort of very medieval thought processes. And when you're conflicted with that sort of on a daily basis, you know, the comedy just happens automatically. So I feel like being a comedian in India is a bit of a cheat, because all you have to do is just observe and write stuff down. there's, just at a basic level from what you guys are discussing, you know, at one level, there is huge advancement in sort of women in the workplace in India, right? Mm-hmm. And at another level, there are sort of, you know, values from the 14th century that people are trying to come out of. So if every day you're confronted with stuff from the 14th century and the 21st century,
That's crazy.
Like a half an hour commute,
you're going to find some funny things on way.
Yeah, correct. It just happens. Yeah.
Would you say that you're actually funny just in... You're a comedian, but would you say you just make jokes in normal every day?
You know, I'm probably not as funny as, say, my parents or...
Probably not that funny, to be honest with you. You wouldn't really giggle that much. But it is true, isn't it? Comedians, I think, and I know that with my friends that are comedians, you constantly, it's like, tell me a joke. Does that get annoying to you? Do your friends treat you like that or not?
You know, I always compare it to, like, certain professions where a lot of skill is required. Like, for example, if a brain surgeon was at a dinner party, people wouldn't say to them, you know, can you just perform an open brain surgery to tell us that you're not lying. But I guess ours is a profession, or even like a flight attendant. People wouldn't say, can you do that thing with the seatbelt to tell us that you're a flight attendant? But with us, you know, I think people always want to sort of test And I'm okay with that because I feel like they're making you work for your dinner. You know, they're just not taking your word for it.
Well, of course, well, you have quite a good talent. You make people laugh. That's the fruit of life, my friend.
It is.
That is one good talent to have.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, but the hard part in our job is it's like mathematics, right? Like if you write drama, you know, people could be sitting there very quietly through whatever you've written, you know, if you're doing a one-person piece or a movie or whatever, and you don't really know how they're feeling. Come back and say, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. But they look very serious, and you've written drama, so their face is not giving it away. Ours is sadly like mathematics, you know? Either people have laughed or not. So you could go back to the green room and say, I had the greatest show in the world, and you can just tell that people just, you know, want to beat you up.
Well, I hope not.
I really hope not.
Anuvab, I know we don't have too long with you. I believe you've got a BBC Radio 4 series due for broadcast later this year.
Yes, yes. You know, the thing is that... you know, where I live around a lot of sort of buildings left from the days of the empire, you know, and the interesting thing is there's been a lot of debate about sort of Britain in India, you know, lately, about whether it was a good thing, it was a bad thing, did good things come out of it, or bad things come out of it. And, you know, I mean, at a basic level, the good thing is that it gives, you know, there's a language and we can have a conversation, so that was good, I think. But I was touring with a British comedian, and we both sort of said that, you know, wouldn't it be nice to just go around and see all the buildings that were built during the empire in India and in Britain, and to see, you know, whether they were built with loot money, or because they look very similar. You know, there are eerie parts of India that look very much like London. And I always wondered, why does it look like, you know, why do we suddenly have a replica of the St. John's Cathedral, you know, in the middle of a very Indian street? You know, why is there a giant statue of Queen Victoria in a city she never visited?
Wow.
So and how must the locals feel about that? Because they have no idea who that person is, right? So they must be like, well, she must be someone. So it was, we've always been interested in that. So Andy Zaltzman, who's a British comedian, and I were sort of going on this tour, if you will, of India and Britain, and trying to look at all the buildings of empire, you know, and whether they were, you know, there's no idea. But, you know, there's been a lot of debate lately on you know, the empire is a good thing, and I think it's firmly concluded that wasn't a good thing. But we're out to prove the buildings can't be a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, railway stations can't be a bad thing, you know.
So, well, Anuvab, sorry, we've got to say our farewells. But your show, The Empire, is going to be running from Tuesday the 1st to Saturday the 5th of May this year, 7:30 p.m. at Soho Theatre in Dean Street. Thank you so much for joining us today, Anuvab.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Bye, my love.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
There we go, that is Anuvab. We are going to go to a very quick song. This is Celebrity Skiing by Hole. Don't go anywhere.
Oh, make me over. I'm all I want to be. A walking study. Look at my face. My name is Might Have Been. My name is Never Was. My name forgotten. Hey, so glad you could make it. Yeah, now you really made it. Hey, there's only us left now. When I wake up, if my makeup, it's too
There we go. That's Celebrity Skin. Hole and on the phone line right now, we've got multi-award winning author, feminist, women's rights activist, is Louise O'Neill. Louise, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hi.
Thank you so, so much for being part of our show. How are you today?
I am very well and all the better for speaking to you.
Do you know what? That is lovely.
Yeah, what a ray of sunshine on our Saturday morning.
This is what we need. Louise, your new book is out on March the 15th and it's called Almost Love. Can you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Almost Love is about a young woman called Sarah who becomes embroiled in this very toxic love affair with an older man called Matthew, and she becomes increasingly infatuated with him and really desperate to win his approval and to prove herself worthy of his love and respect.
Oh, we've all been there.
Yeah, I know. Oh, God, we all have, unfortunately. The affair doesn't last long, but it has very long-lasting repercussions for Sarah's, you know, her career and her relationship with her father and her friends, and I think more importantly, really, though, the way that she sees herself and how she feels about herself. Mm. So it's a book about obsessive love, about desire, about power dynamics between men and women. I'm really proud of it. I think it's probably my favourite of my three books so far, so I really hope other people enjoy it too.
Oh, I bet they will. When is coming out very soon then?
No, it's out at the moment. It came out last week in the middle of, like, it was published in the middle of the worst snowstorm that we've seen in Ireland
for
30 years.
So isn't that typical?
The entire country was brought to its knees. No bookshops were open.
Yeah.
But did it feel so good when once you put it out, like the feeling of releasing a book that you've been working so hard on was such a good feeling?
It is. I mean, it's also very anxiety provoking. You know, you do tend to feel very nervous because you're hoping that people will respond to it and that the book will resonate with people. But I mean, the response so far from readers has been really astonishing. Like, you know, all these women emailing me and sending me private messages on Instagram and Twitter just to tell me their stories of their Matthew and to just the time that they, I think, fell into this sort of obsessive relationship and found themselves acting in ways that they never thought they were capable of. So that's been a really, really interesting experience to see how readers are responding to it so far.
That is amazing. And I really hear that your debut novel, Only Ever Yours, won Newcomer of the Year at the Irish Book Awards and the inaugural bookseller YA Prize. That is incredible.
Oh, thank you. I was very, you know, I feel very fortunate. You know, people have always just been very kind and generous about my work and very receptive to it. And I think as an author, there's not much more than that you could ask for.
Hmm. And does it give you pressure, you know, I guess when your first book wins such that respect and accolade, does it give you pressure on your second book that you've got to live up to expectations?
I have my second book was Asking For It, and that actually won the Book of the Year at the Irish Book Awards. It won the overall category.
Wow.
So this is my third novel. Yes, yeah, so I did feel the first two, I think, were so successful that I did feel under a lot of pressure with the third novel. But I think I took a step back and I asked myself, I said, what is the book that I would want to read? And Almost Love is it, because I'm really interested in the complexity of human nature and how men and women interact with each other and the intersection of class and privilege and gender. And also, I just want it to be a really good story. I think for me, that's the most important thing, is that, you know, someone picks up the book. And what most people seem to be saying is that they're reading it in one sitting, that they just physically, you know, can't put it down. And for me, that's, I think, the greatest thing to hear is that someone finds your work well-paced and compelling.
And so much that they reach out to you afterwards as well, which is even more fabulous.
Yeah, no, it's been really nice, I think, to have that connection with the reader. And, you know, I have a lot of issues with social media, but I will say that
yep.
The way that it has broken down the barriers between, let's say, the author and the reader has been, I think personally, is really lovely.
Yeah, totally.
Louise, we're going to have to say our farewells. Louise O'Neill, your new book out now called Almost Love. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take care, Louise. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
They get Louise O'Neill there, multi-award winning author, feminist and women's rights activist, and her new book, Almost Love. Very busy show. It's been full of people. It's been fantastic. If you have just joined us, welcome. This is our Eva She campaign live 24-hour marathon.
24 hours. I don't know how you're doing it. How are you? How are you over there?
I'm all right. I do feel I've hit a little teeny tiny wall, but there's nothing caffeine won't sort out for me. I feel, yes, we will get there.
As well as studio snacks, which are en route right now.
He's on his way. I'm going to get the studio snacks. Minka, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about you for our listeners.
Oh gosh, what is there to say? My name is Miki Iza, also Cheeky Miki to some. But I'm a radio presenter and I work in the music industry as a radio plugger. So I'm basically lots of chasing after rappers and making sure that they're happy, which is a very interesting job in itself.
I bet that is. I bet you've got some stories to tell.
Loads of stories. People always ask me, because if you're looking, you know, if you're organising an artist's schedule or whatever, they're like, oh, like, have you ever been mean to you? Like, are they so demanding? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, sometimes, you know, someone has asked me, you know, for blue M&Ms. If they want blue M&Ms, you get them blue M&Ms.
Does that really happen?
And you eat the rest. Yeah, it does.
Wow.
But more so, it's more on the illegal substances that people are after when they're on tour.
The music industry. We'll be chatting a little bit later on. We're going to just take a very, very short breather, but do not go anywhere.
FUBAR Radio presents Sarah Love and
My Stiggy. How you doing, Desiree? So what about to those people who are like, fine, well, if you've got Black History Month, why don't we have White History Month then?
Because you have White History
Year. Oh, well, that would be every other month.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be every other month, right? I mean, that's kind of what it is.
2018 is meant to be the year of the black woman or something. Is that?
Or
clarify
this
to me.
Well, I always like to say it's when everybody else has already caught up to what we already do.
Pow, shots fired. Go on, Desiree. Preach.
Bruh, bruh. That's a term of endearment, by the way.
Every Monday, Sarah Love and My Sticky from 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
White Owl, let's do it. Drop that.
Well, that was a very sudden, dun, dun. It woke me up. Let's welcome into the studio. It's Charlie Condy. Welcome.
Hello, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. I thought I'd come and share in your experience of staying up. So I've been up obviously all night.
I totally believe you.
Well, you know, in the spirit of he for she and equality, I thought I'd do the same thing.
I'm very touched.
I actually went to bed at 10 last night.
I hate you.
Good 9 hours.
You're actually quite fresh, aren't you?
Yeah, I am really fresh.
Fresh as a daisy.
I don't know if you just want to ask me maybe one question and then I'll give a really long answer and you can just nap.
I've got a pillow, so we're all good with that, aren't we?
Excellent.
Do you know what? One of the things that really stands out for me when I look at your notes is you probably spent years training as an actor, working as an actor, being proud as an actor. You were named Attitude's Man of the Year in 2012. It's a real Dear Diary moment.
I was. It was lovely that actually. It was the first time Attitude had done an awards thing.
And, wow.
And they told me that I had won an award, but they wouldn't tell me what it was.
Really? Is that allowed to happen?
They said, you won, and would you come and have a photo shoot? And I said, yeah.
Could be for anything.
So I went in. Yeah, I know, right? And that was
literally
the worry.
And you're just there like, woo.
And I went into the studio, and there were loads of people all having their pictures taken. There were people like Catlin Moran had won Woman of the Year or something, or Honorary Gay or something, I don't know, something. And there were loads of other people there that I knew, and they'd all been told what their awards were, but they wouldn't tell me what I'd won.
Maybe they just loved the shock look of surprise on your face. They were gearing for
it. It turned out they were putting me on the cover, so once I'd figured that out, then I was like, okay, I must have
They put you on the
nice.
Cover.
They put me on the cover.
Well, of course, because you're
so
man of the year.
Yeah,
right?
Gorgeous man on the cover.
You're gonna be. That's amazing. Well,
it was lovely.
Let's talk about your time in Coronation Street.
Yes.
What was that like?
What was it like? It was amazing and wonderful and an incredible experience for me. And by the end, enough. Time for me to leave.
Yeah.
I loved it there. And the people are fantastic. And, you know, a lot of the time people talk about Coronation Street being a big family. But it really does feel like that. And it's a great place to work. It was something that I grew up with. So it felt part of my DNA anyway.
How long were you in it for?
I did 4.5 years altogether.
Yeah.
So, it felt significant. But I think my family are down here. I've got two kids and a partner, and the constant commute up to Manchester. I'd go up on a Sunday evening and I'd come back on a Friday night.
Oh, wow. How many? Were you filming every day?
Not every day, no, but if you were in a big storyline, you'd be there every day.
Right.
And then you might get a couple of weeks off, but you never really knew your schedule until the week before.
Because they don't really reveal the stories to you, even the actors, do they?
The actors are the last people to find out.
That's crazy.
And so you wouldn't be able to plan anything, and it was just after that amount of time, I thought, I need to
have a break.
A bit of a break. I loved it there, and I would never say never to going back, but it wasn't.
Can I ask, though, when, like, seeing as you were a character on television, when people saw you, you know, in normal life, and they're shouting your character at you, because I remember, like, when I saw Minty from EastEnders, and I was in Nando's, and I was like, oh, my God, Minty, I didn't know you liked Nando's.
Minty from EastEnders.
Do you know what I mean? I didn't know you liked Nando's, and he was like, well, you know,
why would I not like
Nando's? But you just think so much when you look at a character that you love that you just always like.
People get very confused. There was a woman on the tube station once, and she looked across at me, and I caught her eye, and she kind of went, "Hello," and I went, "Hello," and she went, "I know you," and I said, "Oh, do you?" And she went, because I played a midwife in the show. She went, "Not really a midwife, are you?" And I went, "No, I'm not." And then she went, "No. So what do you do then?" And I just thought it was a really odd question. Yeah,
that
what
is
do
a,
you do then?
And
I was like,
so
well, I'm an actor.
I pretend to be a midwife.
She got really embarrassed and went, "Oh my God, of course you're an actor. I'm so sorry." But it was just that kind of, she knew I wasn't a midwife, but she didn't know what my actual job was.
Mm.
So people get confused about the show.
How was it an easy decision? You know, you've gone, you know, maybe, you know, as an actor, like trying to get work, then you get this contract with Coronation Street, 4.5 years, to then go out of the comfort of that job, of that regular work, to go back out into the real world.
Yeah,
as an actor.
I suppose. I think, I don't know really. I've never really thought about things like that. And I'd always worked before Coronation Street. Oh, okay. I'd 20 years or something in the business before, since I was 18. So maybe, probably about that long.
Wow.
So I wasn't so concerned, and I have worked a lot. I know a lot of people struggle coming out of a soap, and people find
because
it
you're
hard
so...
to get work, but I've been lucky, I suppose.
Yeah, because you're so in tune with your character, and you have been for so many years, that when you finally kind of stray away, it's like, it must be such a weird sensation, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think there are people there that are very much just their characters, and that's what they do, and it suits a lot of people to be there for a long time. There,
Ian Beale,
different soap, but yeah, I imagine he's really good. Well,
I know, I'm like also an EastEnders fan as well. I love all soaps, but yeah.
But it's like Bill Roach, who plays Ken Barlow, who's been in the show since the first episode.
But
so
he
that's
do
must
else.
Be getting on for 60 years now.
Wow,
and he loves it there. So,
does he? All right, well there you go.
Fair play to him.
Yeah, for sure. What would you say? You know, we've had a lot of creatives on the show so far. And they talk about, you know, the hustle, the grafting it takes. What would you say for someone coming into the industry? What it's really like?
Get a proper job.
Yeah, don't do it.
The thing is, I think if you're an artist or if you're an artistic person or whatever, it's in you and it's what you want to do and it's what you need to do and therefore you would expect that you have an element of creativity in you. So I think most actors are capable of acting. Most of them can do it. The hard part when they talk about it being a struggle is the being out of work. Once you've got a job, then you're doing what you love and doing what you're capable of.
Purpose.
And it's great. Exactly. And it's wonderful. But it's when you're out
it's the
work.
In-between.
These are the hard
But this
parts.
Is the creative industry. Most jobs is like, you don't know. They come few and far between. All they have breaks between. You have it's so different that when you're not in it, it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? But once you're in it to win it.
Yeah, that's right. So I think I would say to people, just be aware of those moments.
Yes.
Be aware of the sitting, waiting for your agent's phone or trying to hustle your own work up or whatever it is. Yeah,
that's what it is as well.
Tough.
Hustle your own work up.
Yeah.
Sometimes writing, sometimes looking at other avenues that you can do to create your own work.
Yeah, absolutely. Just stay creative. Stay, you know, using that part of your brain. That would be my advice.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying, because we do live in a world now where we're so, you know, we have links to YouTube and SAGLAND and everything. You can make your own TV show if you really wanted to. We're just in a world where you can be as creative as you want and not relying on anyone else. So guess what? That's something to do in between those moments.
Oh, yeah. What are you working on at the moment?
What am I working on? I've just finished on something that weirdly I'm not allowed to talk about, which is so silly because it doesn't
really?
Help when I'm on a radio
You're
show.
You're really working, are you? I'm working on so
I'm
much.
I'm actually
but
just
I can't
sitting
talk about
waiting
it.
For my agent to call. As I said, no, it's just one of those things. It's a franchise and they wait to announce the cast on a thing. So, it's not anything huge. It's just something that I've been doing that I can't announce yet.
Amazing.
Are you enjoying it? Is it good fun?
I finished it now, but it was brilliant. It was amazing. And now I'm getting my house done up. So I've taken, it was supposed to be 3 months off work to focus on that, but it's
taking me
slightly longer because the builders take longer. So, it's fine.
And you're a patron of the Albert Kennedy Trust. Tell us about that.
I am. Yeah, the Albert Kennedy Trust is a fantastic charity that work with LGBT youth and more specifically homeless LGBT people that have been, perhaps have come out to their family, have been thrown out and are living on the streets. And the Albert Kennedy Trust do a number of things to support them, but often getting them into temporary accommodation so that they're safe and they're not having to go into sex work, which so many people do, or managing to place them with other families or with, there's a mentoring scheme. They do a huge amount. Because the majority of, I think there's a huge percentage of, I can't remember the statistics, but a huge percentage of homeless people are LGBT, certainly under the age of 18, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they get, you know, so many from, often from religious backgrounds or families that just aren't tolerant. Throw them out. And then they're too young to find anywhere, they can't get jobs, whatever, so they end up on the street.
Wow.
Absolutely shocking. I do some mentoring for Centrepoint.
Oh, yeah.
So
a similar kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. And we've actually spoken a bit about mentoring. How important would you say mentoring is? Reaching out to younger people who probably don't have someone to talk to or turn to.
I think
to.
It's hugely important. I I'm a dad and I had a great upbringing and I'm really privileged in that respect. I was very lucky, and so many people don't have that. And we, things that we just take for granted, just having that kind of support. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, we often hear about the importance of role models and people that you can aspire to and look up to. But I think actually what's more important is that there is just somebody there who is older and more responsible and somebody that can
listen,
guide you and listen and tell you that it's going to be all right and help you in any way that they can. So I think I think it's a huge thing, really. And the Albert Kennedy Trust do amazing work with some of the young people.
Yeah, and where can people find out about the Albert Kennedy Trust?
Oh, no, you've put me on the spot. And I know, right? The website.
It's, type into Google Albert Kennedy Trust.
I think it's akt.org, but I might be wrong, so Google it.
Do. The
good old Google.
Charlie,
yes.
Thank you so much for joining
us. You're very welcome. You're very welcome, and well done. I'm really impressed.
You.
Did it seem like a really good idea at the time, right?
It seemed like the best idea. Was it your idea? It was my idea. Yep. The UN and we're here now, but I feel like I'm over the difficult.
You're on the
bit.
Home stretch,
right?
Yeah,
and when it's midday, totally. I'm like, I could maybe treat myself with a little glass of wine midday. Then I've got 5 hours.
Yeah.
Don't know if that's going to be the downfall or the upfall.
It's fine. You can just sit here and look pretty and let people talk around you.
Well,
while you nap.
That's what I do in my work.
Let's be honest, they don't realise. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.
And don't go anywhere. We interviewed the wonderful Ben Azand a little bit earlier on. So we'll be back very, very shortly. Well, in the studio right now with me, we've got Benjamin Zand, documentary maker, filmmaker. I read somewhere journalist extraordinaire, which I quite like the word extraordinaire.
I wonder who wrote that. I didn't write
it's
that.
Good.
I
it's good. It's good. Your mum wrote that. It.
Yeah, exactly.
And also 2016 Young Talent of the Year, the RTS Journalism Award. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I feel like I've been riding off that award for too long now. I need to win another one.
I don't blame you. I really don't blame you. Your CV is incredible. We're all very jealous, and your documentaries are, they're just the stories that you never knew really existed. Let's start right from the beginning. You started off doing a travel website.
Yeah, I did, yeah. I mean, I basically left uni. I did journalism in uni. Mm. It wasn't, like, intentional. I basically failed everything else and I kind of forced myself.
And here we are.
And luckily it worked out and I enjoy it. But, yeah, and then I kind of left uni and just couldn't get a job, essentially. It wasn't a glamorous beginning at all.
No.
So I just set up a website because I was like, what the hell am I going to do with my life? And then I thought, you know, if I have a website, at least then I'm technically not employed because I'm employed by myself, you know. It was very optimistic. And then, yeah, I just kind of made the website, actually at one point I had like 20 writers writing for it, but it's because, you know, everybody needs work, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
And they want to kind of like, you know, get the names out there. And then I kind of started making videos, and I had made a documentary about Iranians living in Los Angeles. And then kind of whilst having this travel website, I just kept applying for jobs. And then the BBC kind of interviewed me for a position, didn't give me it. And I was like, oh my God.
This industry.
Give up everything, exactly. And then they said to me, oh, you know, but you can come in for like an internship. And then I did like a 3-week internship, and then they offered me like shifts. But it was like one shift a week, literally for about 6 months. And I was staying in like a hostel near Pimlico. And I honestly just hated life. So, yeah, I mean, looking back at it, which I actually don't do very much, I'm very happy that I'm here now. At least I can, you know, at least I'm making a living out of it, because I didn't really think I would.
And it's documentaries. Is that something you always wanted to do? Or again, was it a way around to get into the industry and make your mark? And then you realise, I actually love doing this.
No, I mean, I definitely didn't always want to do documentaries, because I didn't really even know it was a concept. You know what I mean? I didn't really know the difference between like a film and a documentary growing up, and I didn't really know anybody who made documentaries. So it wasn't like, oh my God, I want to make docs. Basically, I was in college and I genuinely failed pretty much everything. Well, I got 3 E's and a U.
Good work.
I know, exactly.
What were they in, by the way?
But it was in physics, maths, French and English. And it was mainly because I just didn't do any work. Yeah. I basically went to quite a rubbish high school, then I went to quite a good college, and I just couldn't keep up. And then one of the teachers was saying to me, you know, the best thing you're good at is English, even though you've done badly, you know, you are good at it.
exactly.
Even though you're terrible, this thing you're reasonably okay at. So then from that, I kind of like worked. I mean, I had to give up physics because I failed that. I actually wanted to do astronomy and obviously wasn't going to do that.
No.
So I basically started working hard in English, and then I ended up getting BBC. Can you imagine that? Like, literally, that's the grade.
Oh, the irony.
Exactly. I know.
Written in the stars.
But then, so she said to me, you know, if you're good at English journalism, something you should kind of look into. Mm. And then I kind of started looking into it, and I was like, oh my god, this is freaking amazing. And I kind of hate when people say this, but I had filmed growing up. People always say who make documentaries. Yeah, you know, I picked up a camera when I was 9 years old, which isn't true. But I mean, I kind of, like, you know, had liked filming a lot, and I, you know, always loved the idea of, you know, making things, essentially. And then I essentially went to university, and there was a documentary course within the university, and that's kind of when I fell in love with it.
Oh, wow.
And I genuinely, honestly, there's nothing I could do now, looking back, that I would do anywhere near as passionately. Like, I basically hate everything in the world, and documentary is one of the few things that I don't hate. So yeah, I'm happy I've stumbled upon it, essentially.
And what is it about documentaries that you love so much? Is it the fact that you want those stories, again, that people don't know that much about, to be told, and people who don't have a voice to have a voice?
Yeah, and it's kind of cool that you said to me, oh, the thing that was cool about your documentaries are that they are stories people haven't heard about, because that is genuinely what I want to do. It's just, from birth, was just meet people, see the world, and try and expand my mind, essentially, because, you know, I'm like, my dad's Iranian, but I grew up in, like, Knowsley, which is, like, I think it's like the whitest borough in the UK. So I never really, like, kind of got to, you know, express my Iranian side, or just to kind of try and understand the world a bit. So I was always fascinated with, like, the world, and that's why I was obsessed with, like, astronomy at first, because, like, the stars were, like, you know, the most extreme form of it. And then the reason I just love documentary is that it allows me, you know, I go to different places, I speak to different people who have such contrasting views to me, and literally on a year by year basis, my views of the world completely change, my personal views completely change, my opinions completely change. I can't really say for sure what they are, because they are changing all the time. And also, it's just, you know, the access you get. I get to meet people that other people don't get to meet. You know, you get to go to places that people think are scary, and in reality, it's not really scary at all. And then also, people get to see it. And you know, you came in here and said, "Oh, you've watched the documentary. That's freaking amazing. It's so cool that actually people see things, and then they get to feel emotions that you felt while you were making things." And it's just amazing. It is really an amazing career,
and it invokes conversation as well.
Exactly. I'd be so boring if I didn't do that. Like, I actually don't know what I talk about, because I'm a terrible person at holding conversation. So usually I just talk about documentaries all the time. The issue is, people always say, "Oh, it sounds like you're just trying to interview me," or it sounds like,
you're like, "Oh, it's like, straight in the heart."
I don't know how else to talk. But yeah, so it does. I mean, I suppose it just makes my life interesting, and hopefully I'm slightly more interesting to other people. As
it's true, you are. And one thing I do really like as well about your documentaries and your style of interviewing is you have no fear in when you ask questions. You don't hold back. You just ask questions. It's a lot. I think a lot of us are probably like, "Oh, did he say that? Was a bit." Is that intentional, or do you not actually have any fear?
No. I definitely have fear. It's basically just because I've always been taught by fellow journalists when I was in school that you need to ask the challenging question. It's all about, like, challenging somebody. Like, you need to make sure you challenge them. And I remember, like, when I first started out, I didn't necessarily do it as much. And even me watching it, I was like, "Oh, it's, like, so embarrassing. You just look like a little bitch, basically." You know what I mean? It's like, if you've got into a room and you're speaking to somebody who's reasonably controversial, you need to ask all questions. It's kind of like, one thing I don't do is I'm not trying to show my opinion. Like, I'm not saying, "Oh my god, you're wrong for doing that." I always say, some people would say, because I don't really know what's right, but I always, before I'm going to an interview, I think, what is the question they would really not want me to ask? And then I try and figure out a way to ask it. But I never walk into a room and I never say, "So you hate gay people, why?"
You're not trying to be controversial
reason. I would never do that first. It's kind of like, you have to build up some kind of relationship. But yeah, if I don't ask a challenging question, I have completely failed. Like, that's, I definitely get scared about it, because some people, you know, I remember I was, like, interviewing a drug lord in Lebanon.
This is, yeah.
And I was a bit worried, because, like, we were in a place...
Braver than me.
We were, like, in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, he was, you know, slightly scary. But equally, I kind of didn't think he was going to kill me at that exact moment.
It's a good thought process.
And I was like, you know, I can't leave here not asking him, you know, should you not be in jail? Are you not a murderer? Are you not a criminal? Because you have to ask those questions.
Yeah.
And what I've realised is that most people, as long as you ask them it in a way that isn't, you're not being aggressive to them, they are happy to answer most questions, because they kind of expect it. If you don't think a journalist is going to ask you a difficult question, you're a bit of a dumbass, basically.
It's very true. I hope you say that to the next drug lord that you meet.
Exactly.
What's been the most, I guess, either challenging or controversial documentary you've done that you walk away from that and you're thinking, oh, that was incredible, but you felt that fear? Was it the drug lord time? Or?
Well, it's quite difficult. Like, Dictatorland was interesting, mm-hmm. just because, you're essentially saying an entire country is like a dictatorship, and for me that is like, that's me having an opinion. I kind of do hate, like, now I'm actually going backwards, where I first started out not even remotely being opinionated. I feel like I had like a little year where I seemed to express some opinions, and now I just don't really want to be opinionated anymore, because documentaries shouldn't be about the presenter's opinions, in my opinion.
Yeah,
if you're a journalist, the whole point is that it's not about you, it's about the people. So it's kind of like, now I suppose, and I made one about a place called Tripoli in Lebanon, and loads of people got in touch with me because they were saying that I was making Tripoli look bad as a whole, where it was only one street that was bad. So there's certain things that I regret within films, but I think you always will regret a lot of things. It's one of those things. Documentaries are controversial a lot of the time. You're kind of touching on very controversial subjects. As long as I feel as though I've challenged people, and for me, it's all about trying to be different. Like, I try and be funny in some of the docs I do, because people don't usually be funny in documentaries.
That's true. Yeah,
you know what I mean. So it's kind of like, why not? So as long as I've tried to be different, as long as it's brought up a conversation, as long as I've challenged people who think that they are too powerful to be challenged, then I am happy. But I definitely have regrets, because
we all do.
Yeah, exactly.
Your latest, you've got a documentary here, The Curse of Being Obsessed with Success and the Rocky Road to Happiness. I was looking at this on Twitter, actually. It's so true, because it's like, we can keep on working towards something, and once we get that little bit of success, it's, you want a bit more, you want a bit more. And for the kind of work we do, we're all perfectionists. We want to be the best we can be at what we do. So where do you stop?
Yeah, I mean, so that's not actually a documentary. That's just a poem I put out, essentially. Yeah. I'm going through a phase of trying to just do loads of random stuff, essentially, because why not? Because I don't know whether, there might be something else I love as much as documentary making. So I'm making like a short film as well called The Curse of the Internet Man. And this was kind of like a precursor to it. But yeah, I mean, essentially the reason I did it is because, I definitely, I'm not necessarily entirely happy all the time. And people think that you are. I get so many people get in touch with me going like, oh my God, you get to travel the world.
Living the dream.
You're living the dream. Yeah. You must be so happy. And it's like, no, I'm not, because I'm obsessed with success. And you don't get happy by, being successful. You get happy by, changing how you perceive the world. Mm-hmm. And I have definitely not changed how I perceive the world yet. But I realize that I'm essentially just trying to open myself up more to the world, because I am confused at this point. I don't really go out that much on a Saturday. I'm usually sitting in my house working, because there's something I want to do. And like, I don't see my friends that much because I'm working, and I'm always thinking about working, and I'm always comparing myself to other documentary makers or other people. I'm like, why haven't I done that? Why haven't I done this? And it really gets to you. And I think one thing about making that poem and putting it online is like, the amount of people who got in touch with me afterwards and said to me, I'm exactly the same. Like, I literally think exactly the same. Was incredible. And it's nice that you, once again, about you have that like kind of emotional connection. You could argue maybe I want that emotional connection online because I don't have it in real life, but I do. I mean, I have a lot of friends.
Yeah. Does anyone have any friends for Ben that we can
No, but I have friends, but it's just like, I feel like I've kind of gone into this realm of just being obsessed with being like significant, because I've some reason feel as though I have to be significant, but I realize I don't know why that is.
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote that poem. And I think a lot of people are obsessed with success.
Yes.
And it's just, I suppose, a reminder. It was really just a reminder to me that I decided to broadcast. And a lot of people got in touch with me and said they felt the same. But I don't know when you stop. And I feel like, I think what you have to realize, and what I need to realize, is that it really has nothing to do with where you are at in life. So when people message me on Instagram and message me on Twitter saying to me, your life looks amazing, it's a lie. It's kind of like, my life is amazing if I choose to perceive it as it being amazing.
But you're in it at the moment, so you're not like there going, oh, this is brilliant.
Exactly. In retrospect, it's fantastic.
Yes,
but in that exact moment, I'm thinking much more about what I haven't done yet. Mm. Like, I'm confident if I won an Oscar tomorrow, I would not be happy, because I'd immediately just be like, what the hell? Why am I not? I need to win another Oscar, or
am I not as good as my last?
One Oscar, I haven't won six Oscars. So it's kind of like, I'm at a point now where it's actually not really about the films I'm making, it's about my mind and just trying to change the way I see the world, because it is all about perception. And a lot of people are unhappy, and it's sad, and it makes me sad.
Yeah, and I think it's very well said, hence why everyone resonates with it, because I think we all do on a certain level, for sure. This is our UN UK Women's Show He for She campaign. What would you say are your inspirational women?
I mean, I'd say the inspirational women I've met in my life are definitely women I speak to whilst making documentaries, whether that's fixers, for example, who are in countries that are pretty dangerous and they're going against kind of what the government wants them to do and literally putting their lives at risk in countries where it's a lot more dangerous for a woman to do so than it is for a man. You know, I've met a lot of female journalists. I was in El Salvador recently with a series I did about basically women being jailed for miscarriages and the amount of women kind of putting
themselves...
I mean, it's absolutely insane, yeah. I mean, and the amount of women putting themselves on the line and kind of getting themselves in loads of trouble protesting. I remember when I was making Dictatorland, there was a lady I interviewed in Kazakhstan who was essentially, she was broadcasting a lot of the crimes, a lot of the misdeeds that the government were doing, and her life had literally been torn apart. A guy, a government agent, had essentially started a fake relationship with her, had sex with her, recorded it, put it online to try and make her look like a slut, essentially, and literally destroyed her entire life. And she was still going on to fight against it, both for women, both people who have been kind of, you know, just fucked over by society, essentially.
Incredible.
So they're the people who I respect. I mean, I always respect people who don't boast about what they do, because we live in a time where a lot of people like to tell you they do loads of good stuff. And you know, I've been probably guilty of that in the past, and I'm trying to not do that. I much more respect people who are in countries where you don't get that coverage because the government does not want to give you that coverage, because that would make them get in trouble. And the women who are still going up against the government, who are still trying to stand for women and for society in general, and who are literally being broken every day, that's impressive to me.
Yeah, I think that's brilliantly said. I really, really do. Well, look, Benjamin Zant, thank you very much for joining us today, and good luck with everything and getting your sixth Oscar.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I look forward to winning the sixth one.
Enjoy. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
FUBAR Radio and UN Women UK present a live 24-hour radio show.
24 hours.